Hello, this is Gideon Rothstein, and this is a responsible day for the 24th of Av. Thank you for joining me, and today, actually, we're going to do two responsa. Occasionally, I stumble across two, and either they're related, or one is too short. So the first truth is, the first tshuva by the Chatam Sofer is not too short. We could have done it in our whole time, but I'm going to have a slightly more, I wouldn't say superficial, but slightly less detailed discussion of that, because I found the tshuva of Yosef, Revad Yosef's, on a sort of related issue. Both of these are on how to deal with those clamoring to sin, those who want to sin. What do we do in reaction? How do we react to such people? So the first case was in Shut Chatam Sofer, Chelek Dalid, Eben Ezer Bet, Siman Pei Bet. It's in Chatam Sofer, the fourth part, the Eben Ezer part. It's the second Eben Ezer that he published, I think, is the story, and it's Siman Pei Bet, responsum 82. There was a woman who was Zikuka Liyabam. So Zikuka Liyabam means that sadly her first husband passed away without any children. By Torah law, she should have Yibum. She should marry one of this man's brothers. But and if not Yibum, she would have Chalitza. Sadly for her, the Yabam is 6 years old, meaning there's only one other brother, and he's six. So when he's six, he can't do Chalitza or Yibum. So he's going to do a Chalitza, but she's going to have to wait for 7 years till he grows up to get it. And this happened, I guess, this would happen in sort of, let's say she got married at 14 or 15 to her husband who was 14 or 15. Something happened, sadly, he passed away. And you have only one brother who is this much younger. So the Chatam Sofer says, well, you can't say she can get married because she has to wait for the Chalitza. So now, that was a discussion they'd already had. The Chassid Sofer had already written this rabbi about her, that she can't get married. You can't say, well, too bad, you know, she can't wait that long. She has to wait. And now she comes back and she found doctors, experts, who say that if she's left this long, it's possible she'll get sick, and it's possible she'll get deathly ill. So this rabbi is writing the Chatam Sofer. Can we believe the doctors and therefore say that she is now in danger? And if she's in danger, so we have a general principle that we save people's lives, even for a safek pikuach nefesh, even for a doubt of things. So if they're saying there's a chance she will be in danger for her life, is that good enough to count as pikuach nefesh and allow her to get married and to not wait for the chalitza or the yibum? And the way he expresses it is, im yesh la'amin la'rofim al adam shehu bari, do we believe doctors about a well person standing there in front of us, and we don't sense any illness in this person? Do we believe them to allow an isur? Do we believe them to let us say, okay, we can violate the Torah as we would to save lives? So this is a tshuva that's written a long time ago. This is a tshuva written on the 24th of Av of Tuf Kuf Tzadi Dalet of 1834. So it's 180 years ago. But the question is a good one, because that could easily come up in preventive medicine today. If a doctor today, I don't mean the doctor took a CAT scan of this, but a doctor today said, you know, these signs in the blood level are such that they suggest that, now you could have two things. Let's say a doctor says, you know, I took blood tests and this person has something that's going to come up in 12 hours, but we don't see any signs of it yet. But the doctor says, well, listen, you got to trust me, and it's Shabbos. Will we violate Shabbos for that person? That's one question. But this question is not quite that question, because that question is a little more serious, a little more pressing. But let's say the doctor says, you know, I've seen this person's cholesterol levels such that they have to do X treatment. Today the treatment would be give them, you know, statins, which has no halakhic ramification. But let's say the treatment was this person has to eat pig for the next 10 years, or else they might get a heart attack and die, because that's what the blood levels show us. So that's the question. Do we allow the doctors who are looking at something, we don't see any sign of illness currently, is that enough to allow us to violate Isurim? So first, the Chazal Sofer says, you've got to know, if we see and sense that a person is ill, then we certainly follow the doctors and violate Shabbos in all the ways that we can, other than the three major prohibitions for which we're not allowed to, which would be Gilui Arayot, sexually inappropriate relationships, murder, and Avodah Zarah. So if we were to assume that this was a pikuach nefesh situation, the Chassam Sofer just pointed out there's another issue that just came up, because maybe this would count as a kritut, as an arayot, because in terms of arayot, for these purposes, the Chatam Sofer says, that would be true even for lavim, even for ordinary prohibitions, such as hugging and kissing. That would be a yehareg bal yavor, meaning, let's suppose, take an arayot, let's say, for whatever reason, one has to save one's life, one would have to have inappropriate relations with one's sister, right? Siblings would have to have inappropriate relations. So let's say, for example, as well, this is Tshuva, you're hearing on the 24th of Av, so just recently on Tisha B'Av, we have the terrible kina about the siblings whose masters wanted to mate them with each other, and they cried themselves to death in the kina. So if the masters have said to them, listen, unless you have relations, we're going to kill you, that would be a gilui arayot. They would not be allowed to do it because one's not allowed to have a relationship with one's sibling, and therefore they would have to this. But the Chatam Sofer is pointing out that in that situation, it's not just the actual arayot, the full violation that would incur a karet or a mitah, a death penalty or an excision penalty from Hashem, even if they're only going to violate, even in quotation marks, they're only going to violate, or only in quotation marks, I should say, they're only going to violate a lav level, a ordinary prohibition level of that prohibition, such as hugging and kissing, that would still be a yaharig val yav, where the Chasam Sofer says. The question of hugging and kissing, how much it counts, as whether it's a lav or not, that's a machlok of Rishonim. The Chasam Sofer is just pointing out that those things that count as a lav, as an ordinary prohibition, would be included. But here's the but that will help us out. When it comes to chai ve'lavin, when he says lavin, when he says ordinary prohibitions are also included in gilui arayot, in terms of having to be killed or having to die rather than transgress, that means within an existing death penalty relationship or karet excision relationship. So a sibling would be, even the lavim part, even the parts of having relations with a sibling that are not covered by the full prohibition, but are in quotation marks, only the lav, the regular prohibition part, that would be part of arayot. But those relations that the Torah only prohibited with a lav, the Torah limited to a lav, so for example, a mamzer, somebody who was born of an illicit relationship and is therefore not allowed to marry members of the Jewish people, that is all, that it's for them to violate that prohibition. That's an ordinary prohibition, and the Chasam Sofer says that's not an ayeherek ve'al yavor. That's not something that one has to be killed for. So if it came up, however it came up, that somebody said to a mamzer, listen, unless you marry this ordinary Jewish woman, I'm going to kill you and her. So they wouldn't be required to let themselves be killed. They would be allowed to violate that prohibition, what the Chatam Sofer seems to say. So how long they'd be allowed to violate it for, we'll get to a little bit later in the tshuva. But that's his fundamental thing. So if that's true, in our case, he says, it's lotia eshet amet chachutza le'ish zar, the prohibition for a woman whose husband has passed away without any children to get married again without a chalitza or a yibum, without one of those two ceremonies, without either marrying a brother or getting a chalitza from the brother, which is what this woman wants because she doesn't want to wait till the brother grows up. He says that seems like an ordinary prohibition. It's lo tihai chameit, the wife of the man who had passed away should not be outside le'ish zar to a foreign man. So Chasam Sofer says, I don't think it's an arayot. He says, but I do remember, or I do know, that it's a more serious prohibition than ordinary prohibitions, because the halacha is, he says, that ein kiddushin tov sin, that if she does get married to somebody else, so there are occasions when the Torah says, don't do something, and if somebody does it, it does take effect. It's actually a long discussion in the Gemara. It's a big fight as to whether, if the Torah said not to do it, whether it takes effect or not. But in cases of marriage, so let's say, for example, a Kohen marries a Gerusha, marries a woman he's not allowed to marry, he marries a divorcee. So that marriage takes effect, meaning she is halakhically considered a married woman. If she, God forbid, had an affair, she and her adulterer would be liable for the death penalty for having had a married affair. Here, the Chatam Sofer is pointing out, when it comes to this woman, she will not, the marriage doesn't take effect. It doesn't take effect because the Torah is saying she can't marry anybody else. And here, we see that it's so serious that we assume it doesn't take effect, and that means that all of the relations she'll have in the new marriage are considered b'ilod znut, as if he's just having a one-night stand. And Chazal called her Eshet Ish in various contexts. So they don't mean it, the Chasam Sofer says, they don't mean it completely literally, they mean it hyperbolically, that since she is violating the terms of her having to wait for her yabam, for her brother-in-law, to either give her a chalitza or a yibum, or to marry her, so that iser of her going out to the market and marrying other people, they called it an Eshet Ish. So all that being true, so it's a serious thing, right? She is, in some senses, still close to being a married woman. She can't marry somebody else. If she tries to marry somebody else, it doesn't count. It doesn't take effect. And Chazal speak of her as an Eshet Ish. Nonetheless, it doesn't make her a full erva. The Chatam Sofer says it's not an arayot, it's not a yeharik val yavor, and that would mean not only is it an arayot, when situations are a yeharik val yavor, that one has to be killed, an extension of that in the Gemara is that one is also not allowed to use that as a way of healing. So the case of the Gemara is a man, however it is, gets so lovesick the doctors thought that he was in fact in life-threatening danger, and the suggestions for how he could get better all involve some kind of sexually wrong activity, and Chazal said not to do it because it's yiharik v'yava. So being mitrape, healing oneself with these items, if they're arayot, would also be prohibited upon pain of death. But here, Chatam Sofer says, because it's not an arayot, you would think that it would be okay for her to take this healing, since as long as we trust the doctor, this is the necessary healing. That having been said, he's not going to go that far. Here, he thinks there are a couple of reasons why it's not true, why we can't allow it, and each one of them is a fully valid reason. First is, he says, there's a whole question about when we trust doctors about things that that they say. If you have a person standing here in front of, we trust doctors, well, we have somebody who's ill, we can sense the illness, and the doctor says what's going on with it. But somebody who seems completely healthy to us, and this person says to the doctor, I have this pain here, or it hurts me here, and the doctor says, I'm sorry, that's when we trust the doctor. But to violate the Torah, I'm sorry, I thought I was wrong, and then it turned out I wasn't as wrong as I thought I was. Somebody appears to us sick, and the doctor tells us what to do. That's good. Somebody doesn't appear to us sick, but he tells the doctor, listen, I have a certain pain. The doctor tells him some medication to take or some action to take. The person should follow the doctor's advice. We trust the doctor. But in terms of violating the Torah and allowing ourselves to violate Isurim, that we're not so prepared to do until there's some sense of actual illness. Now, how you apply that today to things like blood test examples I gave before is complicated, because some of that is evidence of current illness that we're seeing. Meaning the Chatam Sofer is not talking about where you have actual medically based evidence of current illness. He's talking about somebody who seems fine to us, who mentions some little pain, and the doctor says, oh, it must be this. Today, if it was followed up with a test or this, or it would be an evidence question. So that's what those officers are saying. Here, we have no evidence other than the report of the ill person, and based on that, the doctor wants to violate the Torah. So that's a more complicated issue, and he understands that because there's a Magid of Ram in Shulchan Aruch who says there's a difference between a pregnant woman who smells food and gets and has problems on Yom Kippur. The Mishnah says if a pregnant woman smells food and she gets ill, we're allowed to feed her whatever it takes to bring her back and to help her live. But that's an ubarash hericha, and she smelled something and that's caused symptoms in her. But that would be different, the Magen Avraham says, from a pregnant woman who nothing seems to have happened to her, or any other person, meaning she smells food, and even though we don't see any, I apologize, she smells the food, she's a pregnant woman, she smells food, she says, oh, I feel so terrible, I need food, we give it to her. But that's because she's pregnant already. If an Adam Bari, if a perfectly well man whose face has not changed at all, meaning there's no external evidence of illness, even if he says his heart is hurting, the Chatam Sofer says, we wouldn't feed him. So again, today, you'd have to think about what we mean by that, what counts as a symptom and not a symptom. But his point was, if somebody's asymptomatic, then we don't just say, okay, we can violate the Torah to save his life. There's got to be some evidence of illness before we would save their lives by violating the Torah. And there's a Mishnah in Avot that says one of the miracles of the Beit HaMikdash was that no woman ever had a miscarriage from Reach Basar HaKodesh, from the smell of the sacrifices. So in there, the Tosfos Yom Tov at Quarter of Rashi, who said that the miracle was that maybe she smelled it and she wanted to eat some of it and they wouldn't give it to her, and therefore she'll need a miracle not to have a miscarriage. So the question is, though, why wouldn't they feed it to her? If it's a question of Pikuach Nefesh, of saving her life, and having a miscarriage was a dangerous thing, why wouldn't we just give her the food? So he quotes a teacher of, he quotes a Gaon Shaul, I don't know who it is, or somebody, who had said that it's because we're talking about pregnant women who we don't see their pregnancy yet. It's not known yet. Meaning the people, who would we save if she smelled Bsar Kodesh, if she smelled something that she needs to eat? It's a pregnant woman whose pregnancy has revealed itself. But if she's pregnant and it's not revealed itself yet, so we don't know it yet, then if just a random woman in the Beit HaMikdash said, "Ah, I smell that, I need to eat it," we wouldn't think of it, he's saying, as a life-threatening situation, and therefore we wouldn't have given her the food, and that's why it was a miracle that there were never any miscarriages. It means very early stage miscarriages. He adds, by the way, that he thinks that the person himself, so there's a principle in the Gemara based on a verse that says, Adam yodea marat nafsho, people know themselves and their illness as well. That person could violate the Torah on his own understanding of the fact that he's really, really sick and he really does need it. But he doesn't think other people could. So if somebody came to you and you came to Chatam Sofer and Yom Kippur and says, I'm really feeling ill, but he looks fine. He says, I'm really feeling ill. I feel very weak. And but his face isn't pale. He doesn't have green. Right? All the outward signs are good. And we're not on Yom Kippur and they're going to like take blood tests and stuff like that. So Chatam Sofer is saying, what seems to be saying, if you feel like you're ill enough that it's a serious issue and you have to violate Yom Kippur, that's on you, and you are not allowed to in terms of, well, Paschim fear that you're allowed to, because you know the situation. But for the rest of us to violate the Torah based on just that, that he's saying isn't acceptable. Why is that relevant to here? It's relevant to here because that would be a question of her. Here we have this woman who says that she's ill, right, who says that she's ill in a way that if she doesn't say she's ill, she says if she's forced to stay a widow and wait around for her yabam, for her brother-in-law to grow up, that that might cause her eventually of life-threatening issue, and therefore she's ill. So he's saying, we don't know that we can trust her yet. We can't trust the doctors yet about that advanced diagnosis, about that their claim that in the future this will create a life-threatening illness, because when there's no illness here now, we're not allowed to respond to it in the same way. Not only that, even if we were to believe her, and her claim is therefore she has to get married, he says marriage isn't really the solution, because if she gets married, the only thing that's really allowed for her is what would save her life. But once her life is saved, she'd have to go back to her previous status of waiting for the Yabam. So, and we can't know, and he says nobody can really figure out exactly, another question of medical knowledge and how well it captures what it needs to capture. We can't know how many times she has to be with this new man before we will have saved her life. And any time they have relations with each other, they live as married people together without the need of her saving her life, will be a prohibition of the Torah. So Chatzos Sofer says, not that he would, and he's clearful to say afterwards, not that he would ever recommend it, but the truth is, if she's thinking that she's getting life-threatening danger, really what she should do is, she should go have a one-night stand with a non-Jew. Why a non-Jew? Because a non-Jew won't be halachically the same as her violating this need to wait for chalitza or yibum. So he says she could find a non-Jew, she could have relations, and that would save her life. Not that he's recommending it, he's saying, but he's pointing out that that shows why this marriage idea isn't one that should take place. Not only that, he points out that when it comes to using sexual things to allow ourselves to save our lives, he says the Gemara's example that we mentioned before of the man who got lovesick, there the Gemara said, even if you found ways to do it in a way that doesn't actually violate anything technical, by virtue of the fact that it started from a sexual issue, the Gemara there says he shouldn't do any of it. In the story in the Gemara, the man had to allow himself to die rather than be saved by these sexual ways, because it's inappropriate for us to open such doors and to allow such things to happen. And therefore, He thinks that in this case, this woman should not find, is not able to find ways out of this marriage, out of waiting around for this yibam. It's not a, it's a sad situation. It happens, and it's not something you're happy for. And it's not that he's thrilled about it, but he doesn't think that the fact that she brings evidence that she might in the future get ill when she's not ill now, and where she claims that the solution to the illness is having relations with somebody, is getting married, when that's not quite the issue. So that in 1834 was on the 24th of Av, was how the Chatam Sofer dealt with that woman who had this urge to violate the Torah for her own reasons. The next, the other tshuva, the other responsible that I wanted to get to today, which comes from Tufshin Lamed Gimel, 1973, so 140 years later, on the 24th of Av, is Yabia Omer, the 8th volume, Yoredeya, Simon Yudbet, Simon 12, and I, when I get a chance to use a Yabia Omer, I always do, because Rav Yosef did not date his tshuvot as regularly as others, so it's not always true that I find a Yabia Omer written on a particular day, so it's a good opportunity to get to know Rav Yosef a little bit better. And this is a response that he writes to the Tzitz Eliezer, another, you know, favorite of our responsive day, another one that, another postake, another meshiv, another respondent that our series takes advantage of very often. Rabbi Eliezer Yehuda Waldenberg, who was the head of the Beis Din in Yerushalayim, and he had sent Rav Yosef, they were good friends, he had sent Rav Yosef his recent Tzitz Eliezer, volume 11, and he enjoyed it very much, and therefore, and he's hoping that he'll produce many more, and I think he produced another 11, so he did, or another more than that, so he did in fact produce many more, but he's writing to comment on one of the psakim in Siman Nun He, in chapter 55, that the Rav Waldenberg had passed. Rav Waldenberg had passed had written about a restaurant that was getting a heksha from the Rabbanut. It was a hotel, really. And the hotel got a tuda from the Rabbanut saying that it's kosher, and the hotel's fine with that, and they're willing to do all the things the Rabbanut tell them to keep kashrus, and they're willing to do all of that. And they're going to listen to the Mashgiach, and they're doing all the things they need to do, which is a remarkable thing, as Rav Yosef is going to point out later in the Tshuva. It's kind of remarkable how many hotels in Israel make sure to stay kosher because they have clientele that wants to be kosher. And it's kind of a nice part of being in Eretz Israel and of the existence of Eretz Israel, of the land of Israel, the state of Israel. So now, the question was, though, this hotel said, but we have clients who are going to want to eat milchigs too soon after Fleishigs, as far as halacha is concerned. And we want to be allowed to just serve them the milchigs that they want when they want to, and not force them or not be on top of those issues. So the Tzitz Eliezer in 1973, in volume 11 of his Tzitz Eliezer, had said that he doesn't think the rabbinic can do that, because you're helping people who are sinners. You're helping people who want to violate halacha as we keep it, at least minhag, but certainly halacha, as we keep it, and it's sort of giving it official imprimatur, an official seal, an official agreement to violate the Torah. And Tzitz Eliezer had proofs for that. He mentioned, it was apparently well known, it's always sad when somebody says something is well known and you have no idea of it, but he quotes an Akedah Yitzchak. Akedah Yitzchak is a commentary, it's sort of philosophical, ethical sermons that Rav Yitzchak Arama gave in the 15th century, in the 1400s. He was a brother-in-law of the Abarbanel, I believe, on the Torah, and he collected them as a book on the Torah. So there's these long drashot on each parsha of the Torah. So in Akedah Yitzchak, the parsha Vayera, the Akedah Yitzchak had said that a small sin, a relatively insignificant sin in its technical terms, if the public decides that it's fine to do, and the courts won't protest it anymore, it becomes a much more serious sin. It becomes a serious liability for that kihila, for that community. So that is an issue that for me today comes up all the time, and that I meet many people who don't realize it, that very often somebody will say, well, X sin, I don't know why we have to oppose it, why we have to go serious about it, it's not such a big deal, and we can let it go. And the answer is that when communal public agreement comes, that's a level of its own that turns something that might be relatively insignificant to something significant. So to stay away from contemporary examples, so we don't get political or upsetting, that Rav Yitzchak Arama speaks about a situation, that there was a situation where you had a place, you had a lot of prostitution going on. And so what's the problem with prostitution? The problem with prostitution is that you didn't just have prostitution. You had a lot of sexual immorality going on, a lot of affairs, a lot of wife swapping, a lot of all those kinds of issues. And the local Beit Din, so this is terrible because it's Jewish community we're talking about, and yet they're falling into this degraded religious state. So the local Beit Din, thinking they might help the situation, they were thinking, let's set up some prostitutes who are unmarried. And the reason then would be that instead of men having affairs with married women, which is a capital crime in Allah for the man and the woman, the men who felt the need for this kind of release and couldn't get in their marriage for whatever reason and were going to stray, they would at least not do it with married women, and that would significantly lower the level of prohibition, right? So that's the question that came up to the Akedah Yitzchak. The Akedah Yitzchak says there is no right to do such a thing. There's no basis for such a thing because any sin that's done without the permission of the court, then that's each person is a sinner. We all have a relationship with Hashem. Some of us are better, some of us are worse, but it's between us and Hashem. And the Jewish community, though, is not liable or obligated for it. But when you have a small sin, and nonetheless, but the court says it's okay, that would be chatat kol hakahal. That becomes a sin of the entire community, and that's what happened with Stob, and that's what happened in the end of Shoftim, where that concubine gets killed, and the people of Binyamin don't respond. That was their fault for not responding. It became the sin of all of them. So I'm not going to give any contemporary examples, and I'm running out of time, so I want to just save, has some beautiful responses, so let's just get to that without thinking about it. But if you pause to think about it, you'll see that this is an issue that comes up in our time as well, that distinction between when we do something in private, it's just a sin, even if a lot of people are doing it, and when we give that sin official sanction in some way, official agreement in some way, that becomes a sin of the entire community. And Rabbi Yitzchak Rama says that it's better that those sinners do their sin and be a capital sin, and Hashem punish them with capital punishment. All that, as sad as it would be better than that the whole community would be implicated and would become involved in this and become condoning of this. So that shows, Rav Yosef says, I'm sorry, Rama is still talking, he says, we see that the leaders of a generation can't ever think to themselves, we're going to save individuals from serious sin by saying it's okay to violate less serious sins. We can't ever do that in public. That's what Rama says. Rav Yosef says, but it's not exactly the same thing at all, because if it was a situation where if we just stood up for the halakhic issues, we would be able to stand up for them with no cost, then you're right. Then we should certainly stand up against people eating milk too soon after fleishigs, eating meat too soon after meat. We should certainly stand in the way, and we should get in their way, especially if people are leading other people to do such things. But in our times, we don't know how to stop it. Even if we made this hotel not do it, it wouldn't stop the people. They would go off and do it. So that doesn't mean you just give in, right? But that's an important first step, that we don't know how to do this, and therefore that's not the situation that we're talking about. But also he says that our hotels in Israel, this is in 73, and there were many fewer hotels then, are in many months, they're full of people. And many of these people are tourists from outside of Eretz Yisrael, and they're observant Jews, and they come to Eretz Yisrael, and they assume that their hotel is kosher. Right? And they'll eat, and they'll drink, and they don't even think about it. I mean, it's not that they check for a tuda, they just are clear. I know that for me, very often, when I'm in Eretz Yisrael, in Israel, during the Shemitah year, I don't think to check always where I'm eating, and what kind of hashgach it is, what I'm doing, what I'm not doing about the new issues that come up. So Rav Yosef is saying that in 73 about, you know, more basic kashrus. Everybody assumes it's kosher. So if you don't have a mashgiach with a tudah, they're going to go and they're going to eat anyway. But then the hotel people might serve actual non-kosher food, and it's going to be worse. So he's saying, that's going to be worse. So one issue is that we can't stop these people from eating milk after meat anyway. second part of that is, these hotels are an important resource for visitors who come from outside of Israel who assume that they're kosher, and therefore if we were to take away the teudah, we'd have to worry that people wouldn't know about it, and they would end up eating non-kosher unwittingly. And then, the most important distinction, I think, is that in the Akedah's case, they wanted the court to say it's okay to have these prostitutes, to say it's fine. Whereas here, nobody's asking the Rabbanut to say that it's okay to eat milk so soon after meat. So in the first case, I just skipped, there's a short paragraph where he points out the seriousness of premarital sexual relations, according to Chazal, in many cases, meaning even if the women aren't nidot, let's say the women go to mikvah. So first there's a tshuva in the Rivash, where the Rivash had said, the tshuva in the Rivash, who pointed out that that they stopped allowing unmarried women to go to mikvah precisely for this reason, because unmarried women would go to mikvah and then they would have relations. So those relations are technically at a lower level of prohibition than other situations that could come up. And you might have thought that was better. And the answer is, the Rivash says, they specifically didn't allow it because they didn't want people to get used to the fact that they could say that there's a way around to find ways to have sexual relations. And the Ramban, in his commentary on the Torah, says there's a specific obligation on Beit Din to make sure that Jewish women aren't having casual relations when they're not supposed to be, which means anytime that they're not married. So it's a very serious issue. So when it comes back to our milk inflation issue, nobody's asking the Rabbanut to say it's okay to eat milk after meat, too soon after meat, before whatever your custom is, that you're allowed to do it, because the Beit Din, the court isn't doing anything. All the court is being asked to do is give it to Udah that there's a man who's an observant Jew, who's a Yirei Shamayim, who's watching the hotel, making sure the food that comes in is kosher, that it's being prepared in kosher ways, and that's all they're being required to do. And the Rebbe Yosef thinks that it's okay to do that in this situation. He quotes a Rashi ben Achuva who says that if somebody wants to help a community get better and better, they have to go slowly, going from the easier steps to the harder steps and building up, not just trying to do everything all at once. And we have to have understanding of how these things work. We have to work slowly and have understanding for where people are right now. And turning away from somebody who's sitting, not paying attention to it, not insisting on stepping in and refusing to help to allow them to do it. He says sometimes that turning away is a mitzvah depending on what's necessary for the time. And so if somebody sometimes looks away from relatively lighter sins because that's going to help make sure that more serious sins don't get done, that can be better. That's all the Rashba. That's all what the Rashba said. That's all the Rashba said. That's what Rav Yosef saying. Therefore, Rav Yosef says in our situation as well, he thinks the value of having all the hotels be kosher, and he's the chief rabbi of Israel at the time, the value of having these hotels stay kosher way outweighs the need to say, yes, we were not going to look too carefully if people are coming for a milk snack too soon after a meat meal. He feels that since they're not saying it's okay to do that, they're not being asked to put their to give their agreement to it. If Rav Yosef thinks that would be okay. This raises all sorts of really interesting issues, but I'm way over my time. I'll leave them to you to think about these issues of when do we do step in, when we don't step in, and how we judiciously apply the Torah and help bring those who are sadly not observing the Torah closer to Torah observance. Sometimes we have to say absolutely no, like the Chatam Sofer did with the poor woman who would then have to wait till her 6-year-old Yabam grew up. And sometimes it's a debate among great authorities. So he has been thinking that allowing, that agreeing to ignore people eating milk after meat too soon was a problem. Everybody is saying it's a problem, but in the larger picture of what we are able to do today anyway, and of the value of having these hotels have a tudat kashrut, having kosher supervision, he thinks it's a compromise that is worth being made. And that's a responsible day for the 24th of Av. Have a great day.